This is an encore presentation of Unreserved. Enjoy.
I'm no longer a lost child out there somewheres, just dangling around out there. I'm no longer a lost child. I came in out of the cold into the light, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm saying, you know what? My story matters. All what I went through, all the abuses, and I'm here today. I matter.
That's Debbie Paul. She is Mi'kmaq from Shubenacadie First Nation in Nova Scotia. 50 years ago, Debbie was taken as part of the 60s scoop and left in a stranger's house. But there was no record of it. It was a burden of proof she carried for 50 years. Now, after years of searching, Debbie Paul has finally found her proof. But is it enough? Danse Anine Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. When the Shubenacadie Residential School closed in 1967, 12-year-old Debbie Paul wasn't sent home. Instead, she was kidnapped by a nun who flew her out of Canada and abandoned her in a stranger's home in Rockland, Massachusetts. You would think taking a child across the border would leave a paper trail, some records, or witnesses. But for decades, Debbie has only had her word. Until now. The CBC's Trina Roach, an award-winning Mi'kmaq journalist, traveled to Massachusetts with Debbie to help retrace her steps to the beginning of her harrowing journey and finally bring her lost child home.
This picture was taken to give to my mother, and my mother never received it.
At her kitchen table, Debbie Paul and I flipped through old photos from the Shubenacadie Indian Residential School.
My God.
She spent 5 years there as a child.
I know that's me there, but I wish I was smiling. I think I look scared more than anything, because I was scared. I didn't know what was going to happen to me, and nobody cared. You're just a good little Indian, and you did what you were told.
When the school closed in 1967, Debbie was the last student to leave. A Catholic nun kept her back, told her to stay out of sight. Within days, she'd take the Mi'kmaq girl out of the country without her family's consent. A photo from that last day shows Debbie standing, arms stiff at her sides as instructed. Unaware, her life was about to take a harrowing turn. She was 12 years old.
This is the outfit that I wore on the way to the plane. That's my outfit, my watch, my outfit. I was all cleaned up. And they even permed my hair. My hair is straight, actually, kind of a little bit of curly, but they permed my hair. Sister Gilberta permed my hair and that. And my mother didn't even know I was being taken away. She signed no papers for me to be adopted out or taken across the United States border, Canada and United States border.
Debbie says she was singled out by the nun, Sister Gilberta, because of her talent for music.
I was very musical. And I played the recorder and I played the piano and I sang and I could dance. I could do it all.
Sister Gilberta led the school choir, and school records show Debbie won high honors at music festivals.
This is you in the record. You said you were musical.
Musical, yeah.
There you are with the recorder there.
Yeah. So look at this.
There's you and Gilberta there, right?
Yeah. We were singing Ten Little Indians. Now I remember. Ten Little Indians. That was Sister Helena Patrick. And we were singing, you know, one little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians. Yeah, that's what it was. And we were all happy we were little Indians anyway. Actually, she called us savages. She should have written one little, two little, three little savages, just the way they did it.
That's the way they sang.
But we were singing Ten Little Indians.
In one photo, Gilberta wears a headdress surrounded by four little Mi'kmaq girls dressed up in Native or Indian costumes.
Sister Gilberta was all smiles. She's always all smiles in front of the camera, always. But man, that woman was mean. Strict, very strict.
Archival records list Gilberta as disciplinarian of girls.
We'd all stand in line to get our beating. It was church, you stand in line to get your beating. You get your beating, you're okay to leave, you know. But that's how I remember church, praying and getting a beating from her. When I first was there, I was only six. And they said, put your hand out. Nun's going to give you a beating. And the girls, don't you ever pull your hand away. Don't pull your hand away, you know, when they're going to hit you. Someone's going to hit your instincts to move back. We were told not to. We were little. We were conditioned not to. And then, so I wanted to know, being smart ass, I wonder how come, right? So I put my hand on Sister Gilberta, missed me. And she took my hand, and she beat me with that strap. A strap is horse hide or whatever it was, and it hurt. My hand was hurt and stuff like that. And then big girls said to you, don't you cry. Don't cry. Take it. And you know how strong your mind is when you're telling a little girl, don't you cry, and you're beating the crap out of her, you know, just because you moved your hand. But that's pretty mean. That's not the only time she was a disciplinarian. She did a lot.
Sister Gilberta's real name was Eleanor Keller. When the school closed, she lured Debbie to the airport with the promise of music lessons.
I didn't realize where she was taking me. I didn't know where. I mean, I lived in that residential school for 5 years, you know. I didn't know what a plane was, whatever.
The nun flew Debbie from Halifax to Boston. No one questioned her about traveling with a child.
When we went across the border, it was like show and tell. I got this cute little Indian girl. She's my ward. I'm looking after her. So sister, in them days, I guess you didn't have to have paperwork at all. Couldn't have, because I had no paperwork going through. Sister Gilberta basically pat me on the head. Oh yeah, she said, you know. And so I would just sit there smiling at people. I did what I was told, you know. Don't say nothing, but do a lot of smiling. So I smiled, you know. And so people were, they looked at that, and it was easy for them to go through. It's just, you know, nobody stopped them. You could have done anything with the children, anything.
Sister Gilberta then drove Debbie out of Boston to the town of Rockland and the home of the nun's brother and sister-in-law, Mr. and Mrs. Wentworth. Gilberta abandoned Debbie with them, a white family the girl didn't know. Debbie says she was treated like a maid and abused.
I went through hell.
The promise of music lessons was broken. Debbie was enrolled at the local public school, and as a young Mi'kmaq girl, she remembers being the only person of color and feeling unwelcome.
That whole town didn't want me there. That town discriminated against me even before I knew what discrimination was.
A year later, without notice or explanation, the Wentworths sent Debbie back to Canada by herself.
They put me on a plane. I was only 13. They gave me no paperwork, not a letter, nothing. They just put me on the plane.
Debbie arrived in Halifax alone. No one came to pick her up. No one knew she was coming home. They didn't even know where she had been. She waited for hours, then fell asleep on a bench at the airport. In the middle of the night, a janitor woke her. She couldn't say where she was going, and the young Mi'kmaq girl didn't even remember her mother's name.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today we're listening to Burden of Proof, a documentary by Mi'kmaq journalist Trina Roach. After enduring an abusive year in the Wentworth home, Debbie was shipped back to Halifax. Abandoned again, she tried to put the year of hell behind her. But decades later, the Canadian government would reawaken her memories.
In 2018, the Canadian government agreed to compensate survivors of the 60 Scoop, an era when child welfare authorities removed so many Indigenous children from their families and placed them in strangers' homes, away from their communities and cultures. Nearly 35,000 survivors have applied for compensation. Hundreds have been rejected and can appeal if they provide more information. So while the government says it will pay, much of the onus falls on survivors to find proof, evidence of traumatic events from their childhood, from a time with major gaps in records.
I have no proof, none, no records. They have no records. They couldn't find anything, nothing.
When I met Debbie Paul, she was caught in this appeal process.
And they said to me, unable to confirm that you were placed in a long-term care with non-Indigenous parents within the meaning of the settlement agreement.
She wanted to keep searching. She knew there must be proof somewhere. For Debbie, it's about more than compensation. It's about validation.
I'm not lying. Please believe me, I'm not lying.
I shared Debbie's story with CBC's Indigenous-led investigative team. We dug in. Slowly, piece by piece, the names and places Debbie recounted clicked into place. We contacted the school Debbie attended in Rockland, and they began to search for her report card. Debbie had already made calls to try to find those papers, but had hit roadblocks. We decided to go in person, travel back to the States together with Debbie to help her retrace her steps.
800 feet, turn right onto Myrtle Street.
Oh, we're almost there.
Almost there.
Almost there. And you remembered Myrtle Street.
Take the next right onto Myrtle Street.
Here we go, Debbie. Here we are on Myrtle Street.
Now.
We arrive at the house where Debbie had lived with the Wentworths more than 5 decades ago. They're no longer alive, but the porch, the house, trigger memories of abuse.
What does it do for you to be here now? Like, what does it do 5 decades later for you to stand here and look at the house? Does it help?
It helps to heal, to face it, not to be scared of it, to face it, to look at it and look at it in the face and says, yeah, I faced it today. I faced the wrongdoing that was done to me today.
Debbie wants to revisit another house she remembers.
I always gravitated to the piano. I just love the piano. And Mrs. Rome, 86 Summit, her house way down the end of the street, she had a piano. I was friends with her daughter, and we'd play in the schoolyard and that, and then we'd go home. I'd do my chores, and then I would go down to their house. And Mrs. Rome would always, always let me play the piano.
We drive down the road, the same short distance Debbie used to ride her bike, to a small bungalow where Mrs. Rome lived.
The house is still standing. The memories are still there. They're good memories. The other place was bad memories, but this little house is a good memory. I love it so much. Good house.
Debbie found refuge here as a child.
I mean, there was a lot of love in that house. You know, I didn't get any love out there unless it was abuse, physical abuse. But here, there was a lot of good, you know, you're a good girl, good job, or I like what you're playing, or I like what you're singing. I mean, it was love. They gave me so much love. Love I really needed, and Mrs. Rome did that. And her kids just loved me, and I loved their kids. I just loved it here, you know. When you're in a residential school, you don't get loving. When I went to Mary, Mrs. Rome's house and stuff, she gave me love, she gave me huggins, she let me do things, you know. This woman and her family made me feel welcome. They did not judge me. There was no discrimination, nothing. I was just pure acceptance. Human to human, I guess. That's the only thing I call it. Human to human. They treated me like a human being with respect, dignity, love.
Debbie wonders how different life would be if she had lived here instead of with the Wentworths. But the Romes moved away long ago.
You have these memories here and you can place yourself here.
Yeah.
But now you still need the paperwork.
Okay. Let's go get it then.
Let's go get it.
We get back in our car and drive along the town's main street to the Rockland Public School. Inside the school, an administrator is waiting for us.
So this is Debbie Paul.
She hands Debbie a paper. It reads, Student Record, 1968, Deborah Ann Paul, under the guardianship of Mrs. John Wentworth.
Mr. John Wentworth. That's that, and it's got the seal. And that's, my God, that's the
family
proof.
You lived with?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the family I lived with. Oh, my God.
Finally, proof.
Mrs. John Wentworth. Was my guardian.
So it says you came and enrolled in
67,
school on September 6th, 1967.
Yeah. Left June.
You left June 18th?
Yeah.
So you were here for one school year.
One school year. Did I get any Fs?
I don't think you did.
No, I didn't.
Debbie, how does it feel now to see that this is what you... This is you.
Yeah,
this is
me.
Record, and this is what you were looking for.
This is what I was looking for. Guardian. My God, went through. This proves everything. This little piece of paper. And if the 60 scoop doesn't accept this documentation and it's got a grand seal.
Yeah,
it's sealed and everything. It's not made up. It's sealed and stuff like that. And you know what? Then if they don't accept this and they write me another no, you know, it just goes to prove that they're just... How many people did they dismiss so far without not filing any papers? I waited 2 years for a consideration. Telling me, oh, you don't need your records, and then they couldn't find my records, and I had to go out and get them. Just because of that stupid little thing there, that stupid page, it says, since we couldn't find them, then you have to go and get them. And how long did it take? It took me forever, but you guys were on the job, and you did it, and you got me here. I just hope this will help people, will help all the ones that they say, you know, you didn't experience that. That didn't happen to you. Well, it did happen. And it's unfortunately, but it did happen. And it's just to say, here's my proof.
We have one more surprise for Debbie. In our research, we found Mrs. Rome. Mary is now 93 years old and eager to reunite with Debbie. We connect the two over Skype.
Hello.
Hello, Mrs. Rome.
Debbie, how wonderful. You made me cry.
Me too, but you didn't change much.
Oh, Debbie.
The women lean toward their computer screens and hold up photos of one another.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you see it clear?
Yes, I can.
Where is that?
Oh, my God. I don't know, but I look young.
Isn't she sweet?
Yeah.
That's my girl. Isn't she
That's
sweet?
That's your girl.
Yes, siree.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm so glad to have these pictures still. Wait till I show you the other thing.
Okay.
Mary holds up a brown doll with braids and regalia.
Debbie's little Indian doll.
You sent that to me the first Christmas you were gone.
Oh my goodness.
And I sat with it and cried.
Oh my God, I can't believe it, Bana. You just look the same. To me, you look the same. You didn't change.
I didn't have white hair then.
You got beautiful white hair. I just want to reach out and love you and hug you. And I love you so much. And I love your family. And I thank you so much for giving me so much love.
We didn't give you enough. We could have given you so much more.
It was enough for me. It was enough.
Good.
Okay?
That feels good to me.
It was enough.
It feels real good.
Debbie may never find the answers to some of her questions. How and why a Catholic nun took a young Mi'kmaq girl with a talent for piano and left her in another country? Will she receive compensation? Is this enough to prove her life was, in fact, uprooted? But she finds closure.
I'm no longer a lost child out there somewheres. That's what I'm taking home. I mattered.
That was Burden of Proof, a documentary about Debbie Paul's journey to prove what happened to her as a child. Debbie's story was told by investigative journalist Trina Roach. Coming up,
I was riveted. And anytime as a journalist you're riveted, you know that it's a story that will draw other people's attention as well.
Trina tells us why she wanted to make the trip with Debbie and what she's learned from that incredible journey. Taking us there, the great Willie Dunn. The folk singer had Mi'kmaq and Scottish ancestry and rose to prominence in the late 1960s. This is I Pity the Country.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of the man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. Bill of Rights throws me chills, they all know me. Frustrated art churchmen, saving a soul man. Tinker the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they paw me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. My body, the trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police they arrest me, materialists to test me, pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting lost for me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition, continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man thrives on hate.
That's I Pity the Country by the legendary Willie Dunn. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, the story of a child's survival and the tenacity it took to prove what happened to her 50 years ago. Trina Roach is the investigative journalist who brought us Debbie Paul's story. She's a member of the Glooskap First Nation and an award-winning Mi'kmaq journalist who teaches journalism at the University of King's College in Halifax. Hello, Trina.
Hello, Rosanna.
Well, this is just an incredible story, and what a journey for both you and Debbie. When did you first know that her story needed to be told?
I was working with CBC. The Investigates team set up to look into residential schools. And I said, you know, it's important to ask in the community, you know, what research that people in the community want to have done. And I talked to someone who lives in Sebaganagadi. He's a neighbor of Debbie Paul. And the first thing he said was, you need to hear Debbie Paul's story. And so I had a long conversation with Debbie. We spoke for about an hour just over the phone. And as her story unfolded and her memory is so strong and I was taking notes, I was just, it was so compelling right off the bat. And I thought, oh my goodness, like this is a story that needs to be told. She's ready to tell it. It hasn't been a story that she's like repeated very often, but she's ready to tell it now. And she needs to tell it so she can get the compensation that she deserves.
And what struck you most about her story?
This is a story, you know, that really took place 5 decades ago, but still it impacts how Debbie sees herself. It has shaped her. She still lives with that. Like it still impacts her today, and not just in terms of the compensation, but how she sees herself, how she still has to remind herself, you know, that, you know, I'm not that kid anymore, that I matter. And she said that again and again throughout the story in conversations I had with her off camera many times. And so I thought, you know, this kind of trauma that Indigenous peoples experience, it doesn't go away. You know, you don't just grow out of it. It sticks with you and shapes how you see yourself and how you think others see you for the rest of your life. So yes, that's unique to Debbie, but I think it's probably something that a lot of people can relate to, especially survivors.
Absolutely. You know, there's so many reflections and things that seemed familiar to me in watching that story and listening to Debbie's story from my own mother's, you know, residential school past and so on. The story that you wrote online is aptly called Burden of Proof. The government claims it's willing to compensate 60 Scoop survivors, but the onus is on them to provide that paperwork, that proof from their childhoods. How difficult is that for survivors?
It's very challenging. You have, you know, Debbie, who is not on Facebook, not someone who can do, you know, extensive, deep research. I mean, she was trying. It's not like she just started when I got involved. But she felt that the challenge for her is, I mean, you know, it's traumatic. It also requires research skills. And the papers she needed are in a different country. And I tell you, like, it's not just Debbie who wants records. Like, that is a repeated theme that I've heard in conversations with other survivors. I just want the records. I just want access to the records. And some of those records are available either, you know, through the federal government and Library and Archives Canada or the National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation. The records that they get, they're sort of, you know, putting them online as they're able to. But you still have to be able to navigate through those sites. And it is a massive challenge, I think, when you're looking at a certain demographic that's aging, to be able to access that kind of information.
Mm-hmm. And you were able to track down those records from the school that Debbie attended in Rockland, Massachusetts. And you decided to travel down there with her. Why did you want to make that trip together?
You know, I think for Debbie, you know, she was keen to tell her story, but really she was nervous to go. And to know that she would be going with me and Jillian Taylor, a CBC producer who's also First Nations, and myself, who's Mi'kmaq, that was comforting to Debbie, you know, so that she wasn't there by herself having these moments and maybe not even finding what she needed.
Right. That's interesting to me that you pointed out that you as a Mi'kmaq person and Jillian Taylor as a First Nations person went with her. Do you feel that it made a difference that you were Indigenous and had the knowledge of that history?
I think it did. It made a difference for Debbie, and I know that because she just said it. Right. She said it. But she felt like she could trust us, that we got it. And I have that feeling too. Like,
You know, I've spent my whole career, like I am Mi'kmaq, but I've also spent my whole career telling stories about Indigenous people, about Mi'kmaq people. And I think that being Mi'kmaq doesn't inherently give you some sort of ability to do sensitive storytelling. Mm-hmm. that is a skill you sort of gain over time in terms of understanding that, you know, I bear a responsibility to people in my story. And I always wonder if that's more than if I just worked in mainstream news and was covering, you know, City Hall and this and that. Like, when you're going into Mi'kmaq communities and you're sort of stepping into people's lives, you know, there's a weight there and there's a responsibility, and you learn that if you're going to earn that trust, you have to keep that trust and maintain that trust. The relationship between you and the person you're doing a story on takes on a bit of a different feel.
Yeah. What are the moments you'll most remember from that experience?
I have to say there's two, and I think they stand out in the story. When she saw her school record, the emotion in Debbie, the sense of just knowing how important it was, even if she doesn't get the compensation, just the fact that it proved her story was true, that sense of validation, which was so important to Debbie. And Debbie said, you know, I matter. And that was incredible. But the phone call, the Skype call with Mary Rome, who's now Mary Shanklin, I mean, I was standing off camera crying.
Mm-hmm. And oh my even gosh, like, I was weeping like a baby.
Oh gosh,
so beautiful.
It was. I'll just never forget that. I'll just never forget that.
Often people think that journalists have to be, you know, unbiased and maybe unfeeling at some point. But you're saying that you cried and you had all these emotional connections and feelings with her. How did it feel to hear these things click for her and hear her say, I matter, this is proof, I'm not lying?
It was incredible for me. And I have to say, because now I'm teaching journalism and I've given lectures on this like myth of an unbiased journalist.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that exists. We all have a social location. We all have a point of view. Just as a journalist, the tools we employ to craft our stories make it fair and balanced and accurate, right? Accuracy is the key to what makes journalism.
Right.
And so, you know, if I'm feeling emotionally impacted by Debbie's story, that doesn't make it less accurate. In fact, I think that emotional accuracy is just as important in storytelling. And most times when I've talked to somebody who said, oh, I got taken out of context, you know, they're talking about another interview they did, often they're referring to that emotional, because they might have said the words, like the quote is accurate, but maybe it's the emotional context that they're talking about. So emotional accuracy is just as important. And to get that right, you have to really understand and be empathetic and be connecting with the person you're doing a story on.
Yeah, I'm going to take your class at the University of King's College.
I would love to have you in my class.
Sitting in the back. Thank you so much for your time, Trina, and use your power for good.
Thank you, Willalyn. Thank you, Rosanna.
Trina Roach is an investigative journalist from Glooskap First Nation. She spent months digging into Debbie Paul's story. We reached her in Uktubuktuk, also known as Halifax. Still ahead on Unreserved. During Debbie's harrowing year in Massachusetts, there was one woman who she says showed her kindness and love.
This doll became a symbol, you know, it's a symbol of my journey, my life journey.
Yeah, and you can't have it back either.
No.
After years apart, Debbie and Mrs. Rome are reunited. But first, here's Ansley Simpson with a beautiful song about transformation and tenacity. This is Quay, changing into Thunderbird.
I'm so sore. I'm so sorry. I should have told you so many years ago. When I was young, when I was brazen, and fear was something I went out of my way for. I'll take these strings and this small handful of songs. Yeah, these small hands. rooms full of songs I kept stowed under the shadows of the cedars that held back the steepness as we climbed down to the shore. Build out the fire, watch the flames light up our faces, warm our bodies as the storm rolls in. Time our exit just as the lightning cuts the beach, points like fingers through the blackness out of. Out of reach. And if you need me, I'm on the second floor, wielding talons from the bruises on my feet, feeling for feathers to push through all the spaces in my spine, where our backs used to touch as you leave. And our bones have mostly healed, but when rain hits metal, all I can taste is past, and my body starts to brace. But when Jimmy hits the gas, and if you need me, I'm on the second floor, bending willows into wings, forging feathers from yet another failed attempt till the security guard.
From her debut album Breakwall, that's Ansley Simpson and Quay, Changing into Thunderbird. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Debbie Paul is now 66 years old. She still remembers Mrs. Rome, the only adult, Debbie says, who showed her any kindness after she'd been uprooted from her First Nation and her family as a child. Mrs. Rome, as Debbie knew her, lived up the street from the home Debbie was forced to live in Rockland, Massachusetts. Her name is Mary Shanklin now, and she no longer lives in Massachusetts, but right here in Canada. She is 93. Hello, Mary.
That's me.
And hello, Debbie.
Hello.
Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Well, let's just dive right into this. I was so moved by both your story and your reunion and the love that you have shown each other. I mean, I cried like a baby. So,
well, we cried too.
We were all crying together. What was it like for you, Debbie, to see and hear from Mrs. Rome again?
You know, I thought Mrs. Rome passed away, you know. But she didn't. And when I heard she was alive and they got a hold of her and she changed her name back to her maiden name and that.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I was astonished. I said, oh my God, where is she? You know, I want to see her. I want to reach out and love her and hug her. And, you know, I just wanted to just thank her so much for what that love she gave me, you know, was enough for me, for all my adventures that I went through in my life. But I hung on to that love. I hung on to her memory, you know, and because of her, I don't think I would be the person I am today, because she showed me love. She opened up her heart, you know, and that's hard to do when you're talking about a residential school child, because they kind of don't trust. They don't trust white people too much, you know.
No, you have reason to feel that way.
Yeah.
Now, you obviously have some very dark memories from the school and from your time in Massachusetts, Debbie, but there was also love and there was also joy, and there was those moments where you felt safe and welcome, and that was in Mrs. Rome's house. What kinds of things did you do at her house?
She would let me play the piano. I love the piano, you know. I played with the girls outside, and she invited me to dinner. You know, that was the most, I couldn't believe. I'm an Indian girl. I'm a child. I'm an Indian, you know. And you don't expect to be invited to people's houses. You know, I never did.
But you see, you, Debbie, to us, you were not, I don't use the word Indian, but no. An Indian girl. You were a child.
A child. I was a child.
Like the other
first.
Children. You were a child.
Trial first, but a lot of people, you know, went through life, and you're not, you're an object to do whatever the adult wanted.
Yeah.
That's a sad truth.
Yeah.
A child doesn't have the choices of no power. You're helpless. You need care. And yeah, that's what the Rome kids had, care, and when you were with us, you were the same as the Rome kids. You would play together. If you want to play the piano, play the piano. If you want to climb the apple tree, climb the apple tree, you know.
Yeah.
And do you remember what Debbie was like as a child, Mary?
Yeah, she was just like my Leslie and Amy and, you know, Jonathan and the Dolan and the Kathleen across the street and Patricia. And I name all the little names. Oh, it was a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And people were good people. I suppose it's naive of me not to think there could be somebody, but I didn't know anything like I know now about John Wentworth. No, he just worked at the post office, and you know, and I didn't know. I feel guilty. I somehow didn't know, but should have known. Maybe I don't how I would have known. She was good at hiding things, of course. With fear, you hide anything.
Yep.
And beatings? No. I just wish I'd known. I wish I'd known. And if I'd known, I would hope I would have done something. I know I would have. I know. I'm sure I would have.
This is the path I was meant to take for lessons, life lessons to pass on to people. And this is what my journey talking about in that. It's meant to be passed on to people.
I appreciate what you're saying now. That I appreciate that very, very much. But no child should be a victim to pass on values that we're missing. And
we lived in different times over 50 years ago when I was there. Mm-hmm. Different times now. When I was in that Indian residential school, Shubenacadie Indian Residential School, I was there 5 years, like I said. I was told, all these little kids were told not to talk about it, not to share. You were forbidden to tell anybody what was going on, or you would get a beating. And you learned under those conditions not to say anything. Even with me being the last child leaving, I had my aunt come over. She said, I wish I knew I would have taken you, you know, we knew, but I never shared my story. We were told not to talk, not to say anything. or you would get a beating. And those beatings that we got, they were a leather strap, nice thick leather strap. And we would get those beatings. And you didn't want a beating. And I just learned to shut my mouth. Mm-hmm. Not to say anything.
You coped with it. Oh.
Yeah.
You had no choice.
No choice. None.
And fear is a powerful emotion.
Yeah.
And especially in a child who has no power.
None.
You're a victim of whatever people around you do to you, for you, about you. Your child takes a human child takes so long to mature. It needs such care. You know, I spent my life in education with children, and I've seen a lot. And fear is a powerful, powerful tool if someone wants to implant it in someone and not to tell.
Yeah.
It works.
It does. It
works.
Most of us kids in that residential school, that's what we were taught. Keep your mouth shut. And then when you get old enough and you try to say something, you would get beaten down. And I guess you beat a child down for so long, they just quit. You know,
that's why you're such a miracle. You are a miracle, what you did with your life. Because if you had a perfect, that's a funny word to use. You had a reason to sit in the corner in a fetal position and not do anything with your life at all. And you didn't. I've come to the conclusion through thinking more about connecting with you, and I've always kind of had seeds of thought of this because, I've studied psychology and I'm a psychologist. Yeah. But anyway, you came, something when you were born, it was in there already. That courage or grit or get up and do it, or I don't know how you didn't have any reason to even care to try. How could you trust anybody anymore? How could you any adult at all?
It took a lot.
It did take a lot. Mary, you had started telling me the story about the doll, and I'd love to hear the story about this doll that you held on to 50 years.
It's so cute, the doll, the little Indian doll. And for years and years, she had little plastic moccasins on. Yeah. The first Christmas that you were gone, that doll came in the mail. And I sat with it and cried. I said, she sent me herself.
You know what I did to earn that doll? And when you showed it to me, I said, oh my God, I remember. But
what?
I scrubbed floors. I babysit people. This one man would let me iron his shirts for 25 cents each. You know, I picked bottles. I did things.
Aww.
I bought that doll. Then I had to go down to Shubenacadie and mail it. But that doll represents how, to send it, to be a child and you scrub
floors. I know.
And that's what I did. I babysat people's kids and for a little bit of money. And, my mother and my stepfather drank too much and stuff. So I ended up doing a lot of babysitting and stuff. But that's what I did to send that doll to you. That doll is a journey. I have people who come to me and say, I can't believe she saved that doll. That doll represents everything.
Yep. I had that doll. I came with me. First, I moved to New Hampshire for a couple of years. And then I went back to Rockland again. And then I came to Canada years after that. And wherever I went, the doll always came. Of course. Yeah. The doll that Debbie gave me. Yeah. That's my doll. And without her moccasin shoes.
Debbie, why did you do that? Why did you want to save up and send Mrs. Rome that doll?
I don't know. It was just the right thing to do, and this is going to sound strange, but sometimes you can turn around and tell what somebody needs without even meeting them. without, you just feel it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I felt. I felt when I seen that doll, I bought it with my little bit of money I had. And I mailed it out. I remember that street so well, 86 Summit Street. I'll never
forget. Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mailed that doll to Mrs. Rome at 86 Summit Street, Rockland. You know? I never knew it was going to get there. I had no idea. But I sent it. Because I think in my heart, I knew that was the right thing to do. And I can't believe that this doll became a symbol. You know, it's a symbol to of my journey, my life journey, I guess.
And you can't have it back either.
No.
That's funny. Yeah, well, you know.
And now that you both have had some time to reflect since your first chat, is there anything else that you'd like to say to each other that you haven't yet?
Well, when I wrote to you, I emailed you and I called you an elder. It's you could be old, but you cannot be an elder. You know, not everybody can be an elder, really. But you have that spirit. You taught. Oh. You have that good spirit. You have a good angel, a good spirit. And to me, you know, you gave of yourself. An elder will give of themselves. And that's what you did. So I always knew you by Mrs. Rome, but it was better for me to call you Elder Mary. But I didn't want to call you Mary without your permission. So I called you Elder. And to me, that means so much. That means more than anything to call you Elder. And it's
I love the sound of it. And I actually liked the sound when you said, when you called me Mrs. Rome. It had been a long time since I've been called Mrs. Rome. And it was good memories there too. So,
you know, I do want to come up and visit you and stuff, but I want to wait till this Omicron virus and we get the okay.
Oh, I know. Oh, I want you here. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, me too.
Okay.
I love you. I love you so much.
I love you too. I love you too. I love you more than you love me. Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, sweetheart. Bye.
Bye.
Aw, indeed. I'm sure your next visit will be full of love and kindness. Thank you both for that conversation. It was beautiful and inspiring. That's Debbie Paul and her former neighbor, 93-year-old Elder Mary Shanklin. Some news about Debbie's compensation claim. In March, Debbie received a final rejection letter from the 60s Scoop Class Action Settlement Agreement. But she told the CBC that this isn't the end of her journey. Debbie hopes to find new legal counsel to revisit her claim. She also wants to connect and work with others whose claims have been denied. There are about 10,000 people who, like Debbie, have yet to find justice. That's all our time this week. This episode was produced by Kata Dack, Aaron Knoll, Kim Kasher, Laura Bone-Steubing, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. Shout out of love to Trina Roach for sharing Debbie's story with us. You can find more on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginaskinamitnawi, Egosay.